Hello and welcome to episode 106 of the Blue Cup Tools podcast. I'm Francisco Gonzalez, also known as Grunislav, and with me as always...
Hello, I am Ben Chandler, also known as Ben304, and with us today we are very honored to have a very special guest, Mr. Brian Moriarty. Hello, sir.
Hello.
It's nice to have you on the podcast.
It is. Thank you for coming on our podcast.
Yeah.
It's a pleasure. I didn't know you had one.
Yeah, we...
have a lot.
We are not the most consistent podcasters, but we try and talk about adventure game stuff every now and then.
Good.
Yeah. So we normally have a topic, but we have just like we each came up with a question or two for you. So we are just going to ask the question and kind of have a little chat with you about it. So Ben, why don't you start? put you on the spot first.
Yeah, mine is a kind of complex question. I was thinking about, obviously, I'd like to talk to you about Loom, a game that both Francisco and I admire very much. And something that really interests me in Loom is that you have this kind of fixed narrative path, and you have a kind of meter for measuring this down the bottom, which is really rare in films or books or anything like that. You can actually see the progress of the main character. Was that like a conscious choice or just something that sort of happened as you were making the game?
It kind of fell out of the user interface design. The idea is that as you went through the world, you would gain power, and that turned out to be a visual thing. As you go, you earn more notes, and the notes are kind of an indication of how close you are to finishing, and you don't get the final note until, I think, the very end of the game.
Yeah, it's really interesting to me because obviously the growth of a hero is a very common narrative theme in the hero's journey, but it's very rare to see it represented so visually to me. And like the fact that obviously, like, I just read The Hobbit very recently, and I like the very end of The Hobbit where you sort of have this hero going back and visiting everybody. And obviously the end of Loom is kind of similar in a very different tone to the sort of fun ending of The Hobbit. And I just really like the way that that sort of hero's journey is represented. And it's, I wonder if like games do that in a way that films or books can never really do it. Like, we see our personal growth in a very tangible way, whether it's with a point score or that.
Well, movies and books have a kind of a built-in meter. When you're reading a book, you can tell how far you are from the end.
Sure.
And when you're watching a movie, you know that it's 2 hours long, right?
So yeah. That's fair.
Especially nowadays with Kindles that actually tell you like the percentage of how much.
I love that.
That freaks me out.
Why?
I don't know. I don't like it. It feels like it's gamifying books somehow.
But yeah, and they're also broadcasting that back to Amazon for their nefarious purposes. So.
Well, even worse.
It's like with achievements, you get like 31% of players got this achievement.
Oh man, can you imagine if they made achievements for reading books?
I don't know.
You read 15 sentences. Here's an achievement.
Are they eye tracking you now?
I don't know. Anyway,
not yet.
But yeah, I just really like that approach to like when you wrote Loom, were you thinking of it as like a traditional hero's journey?
I had heard of the hero's journey thing. In fact, you know, it's ironic that Joseph Campbell, who articulated the hero's journey so well in the famous book of his, The Hero of a Thousand Faces, which apparently was also an influence on George. And, you know, Campbell did this entire TV series based on that book under George's auspices. And where I was working at Skywalker Ranch, we were working near the library where that series was filmed.
Oh, wow.
And I've actually sat in the chair where he sat being interviewed for that series.
Wow.
I don't start on a project saying, well, how is this going to map to the hero's journey? The hero's journey is just something that happens when you write a story. It's kind of like the Odyssey, the structure of the Odyssey is wired into us, it seems.
Mm-hmm.
Right? And it just kind of falls out that if you follow your instincts, you're probably going to end up with a story that feels something like that. Right, which is kind of Campbell's point, right?
Yeah, I guess that's like the human experience overcoming a challenge through experience.
Right, right. So this is why the ending, Peter Jackson's ending for his Lord of the Rings trilogy, is so unsatisfying because he didn't put the ending in.
I actually didn't make it past the first movie, so.
Oh, really? Oh my god! They're good. At least the first two are really good.
I don't know. I mean, yeah.
It's interesting reading The Hobbit for the first time and wondering how they made three films of it, out of it, and then getting to the last 20 pages of the book and go, oh, that's how they did it. The last film's clearly just war.
Right. So, yeah, three films for that book was rather excessive, I thought.
Just a little. You're right. Yeah. Especially because I was sort of comparing notes with my girlfriend to see where the first movie stops. And the first movie stops apparently around 200 pages in of a 300-page novel.
What?
Yeah.
Wow.
Yeah, they got. I mean, it should have been a single, like, three-hour film.
Mm-hmm.
Or maybe two films, maybe two.
Hmm.
But, you know, three, they're just, I mean, the thing is, there's money on the table, right? Of course they're going to make three films, right?
Yeah, and trilogies are...
Who doesn't want to do a prequel trilogy?
Right.
That's the cool thing to do.
Oh, yeah, sure.
God. So, I mean, actually, The Return of the King should have been two films. That book is so rich and so full of events, they tried to squeeze too much,
right.
and they left out the hero's return, which
right.
happens in the book really, really effectively, but is only alluded to in the movie and doesn't actually happen, which is bad, I think.
Yeah.
In the case of Loom, I didn't consciously set out to model the hero's journey, but, you know, dramatically it just made sense for him to return to the island to confront, you know, the Flying Forge, right? And the
right.
bad guys.
Chaos and all that. Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Right. I mean, it had to end with the Loom, right?
Yes. Yeah. I'm interested, did you have any specific narrative inspirations for that, or were you just like a sort of patchwork of things you absorb by osmosis and sort of put that in naturally?
So kind of both. It was my patchwork of very diverse sources kind of coming together in an instant when I saw the word Loom.
Yeah, I remember you
it
told
was
that
kinda like,
at
yeah,
your GDC
so if you
talk,
saw my
you told
form,
that,
yeah.
yeah.
Yeah, it was like a bell ringing in my head, and suddenly all these influences coalesced into this complete world, literally in an instant. All I had to do was write it down.
That's
it was
incredible.
Kind of, it was wonderful.
Yeah.
And but you know, I mean, the story draws from many, many different sources. Most notable, obviously, Swan Lake.
Mm-hmm.
But many other sources too. All my games do. My degrees are all in English. I guess I'm pretty well read, although I don't read nearly as much as I used to. When I was a kid, I read voraciously, and mostly science fiction and fantasy. And I always brought all that stuff to the table when making a game, and I brought it all in with Loom.
I imagine, especially when you were writing interactive fiction or text adventures, that was your history in books was kind of a real stepping up point. Like, this is what inspired me. I can recreate this, but let people experience it themselves.
Right. I mean, so my second game, Trinity, has got all kinds of literary sources that I could point to. Some people have found some of them, but some have not been recognized. And all my works have that stuff. I mean, Beyond Zork refers to The Wizard of Oz and all kinds of other things. I mean, I just mix it all together, you know.
I think that's kind of fun. And, like, for me, I guess that's the reason why I wanted to make stuff is because I played and watched and read stuff that really inspired me. And I'm like, I want to make that too.
I guess same.
That's a common thing for creative people.
Mm.
Yeah, you want to respond. You know, these people have produced a response to you, and the correct response is to take what they've given you and rework it for your time.
Mm-hmm.
Right?
Yeah, and sometimes in a different medium, as like us with games. Like, I imagine for you, you were sort of treading new ground a lot of the time back in the 80s when it was...
So yeah, text adventures were, you know, I mean, interactive fiction was new. It was a new creative form had arisen. And, mm-hmm. you know, I was lucky enough to be there at its formation and actually participate a little bit in it. But that's still happening all the time. There are new, with all this technology and stuff, I mean, like walking simulators, right?
Right.
Yeah.
So when they first came out, you know, it was a term of derision, right?
Mm-hmm.
So the supposedly hip game community didn't realize that they had just witnessed the birth of a new medium, and they were deriding it, but now they're winning prizes at the Game Developers Conference, right? And my students are making them, and it's a new... It's not a movie and it's not a game. It's a walkie. I call them walkies.
Walkie, that's a
nice.
Good, yeah. It's interesting.
Actually, one of my students coined the term, actually. But
oh, that's cool. It's interesting to see now how, like, they're diversifying and you have totally different takes on very much the same idea. Have you played, for example, Virginia and Firewatch?
Firewatch, yes. Virginia, no.
It's really interesting to me because one of them, you interact with this character very deeply and it's all dialogue. You never see the person. You only see their environment, if I can spoil it for our listeners. The other one...
If they haven't played by now, they...
We've ranted about
it. Yeah, we've ranted about it enough.
The other one... There's no dialogue at all, and all you get is facial expressions. They literally don't communicate with you other than body language and facial expressions. So you have very much the same approach in terms of like a walking simulator. You're not really solving puzzles per se, but the way that characters express themselves are so polar opposite that you can have these two totally different approaches within a very specific subgenre is really interesting to me.
It's a wide open field. For example, I had a student group last year who made a walking simulator based on the final scene of the Pied Piper legend. Mm-hmm. You wake up in a bedroom and the piper sticks his head in and motions for you to follow, and he starts playing his pipe and you walk out into this beautiful virtual reality simulation of a medieval town, all carefully detailed. It looks like you're walking into a Disney movie. Right. And all the children of the village are running past you. These are AI avatars that are following the piper, and the game dynamically controls the trajectory and speed of the children and the piper so that you can follow the piper out of the village, and it waits for you to approach the main gate and be facing it before he opens it magically and everyone streams out, and then they go into the psychedelic star tunnel and disappear, right? So, it's basically... you're in the story, but you proceed in it through your own pace. If you want to walk around and explore the town, you can, and the Piper will be waiting for you right around the corner, right, to continue the story. You can follow it at your own pace, right? So, interesting creative challenge.
Yeah, I think people want to be involved in games, and to a certain extent, the last maybe 20 years, a lot of that involvement has involved kicking or shooting or punching or whatever, but...
Or even worse, stupid dialogue choices, or just dumb choices that have no real effect, right?
Yeah.
That are put in for pacing, right?
Yeah.
I hate that.
Yeah, that can of worms.
Yeah, but... I'd rather have no choices. I mean, give me your best story. You know, the thing is, it's hard enough to write one good ending.
I say the exact same thing.
It's like more than I can bear to come up with one ending that doesn't embarrass me. I'm supposed to do five now?
Oh, dear.
Sorry.
No, it's fine.
I have said the same thing. Writing a single ending is really hard, especially to get it satisfying. And you can, I think, show exploration through non-linearity without changing the actual narrative.
I think that's what these walking simulators are kind of exploring, right? To give the reader, we'll call them, or the player, or whatever, the experiencer, more flexibility in what they see and more personalization, but without breaking the laws of storytelling, which are wired into our DNA, right? Mm. you can't screw with that, right?
Right.
Well, you do so at your peril.
Actually, right? I have a question. I'm curious what your opinion is on this, because it's a question that I've been thinking about a lot lately, and I've seen it floating around Twitter, and it's this whole idea of the world we live in now. There's this whole culture of live streamers and Let's Players and stuff, and for narrative based games, if you have people that are watching these games and they see the entire linear experience, what incentive is there then for them to go and experience it themselves? And that's kind of been a debate that's been going on. What do you think about the whole idea of, you know, rather than play a game, just sit and watch someone else watch it? Or, sorry, sit and watch someone else play it, I should say.
So my son makes Let's Plays for a lot of games. I don't have time to play all the games that come out.
Right.
I freely admit that I watch Let's Plays of most of the new games that come out because I do not have time to play them. So that's a choice that people can make. Like when The Witness came out, you had a choice. You could either sit there for the 40 to 80, or in my case, 270 hours, because I was a playtester.
Okay.
I was a playtester. But so I played the whole thing twice, once in alpha and then once after it came out. Mm-hmm. And you know, you can make the choice of making that investment, or you can watch the 27-minute speed run of The Witness.
Right.
And see it all at once, right? And if right. that's your level of interest, that's fine.
Mm-hmm.
You know, I mean, the choice is fine. You don't have to go to YouTube. No one's making you look, mm-hmm. right? So,
right.
And you know, and that's kind of an art form itself. So I have a student who was in my classroom who, when I was lecturing, was obsessively speed running The Witness, trying to improve his time. And it turned out that he was spending almost all of his free time exploring The Witness, trying to find something in it that he sensed was there. And it was you know, he was exploring it on at a meta level, not at the level of the designer, but at a, I mean, at a much higher level. And
right.
And that's interesting that people can do that. You know, that people can take your code apart, and I mean, you know, they've already extracted all the image files, all the 3D assets from the
wow.
game. You can walk through the mesh now, and I mean, it's crazy.
Jeez. Yeah.
Yeah.
Wow.
So. No, if people want to do that, that's nice.
I like to think of it as like a guided tour where someone can sort of, you know, if you haven't got the time to study a painting and try and figure out why they made this choice or what this part means, someone can just go, oh, hey, this is what that means. But there's something with The Witness in mind. There's a very particular puzzle in The Witness that when I finally got the solution to it was such a big moment for me that no Let's Play will ever sort of achieve. You know, I just think they're very...
Right. Well, I mean, The Witness is all about insight, right?
Right.
And modulating the emotion of insight. That was the genius behind it, is that mm-hmm. he found to do what's essentially a ludic fugue. and it was genius. And if you just watch a Let's Play, of course, you're entirely missing that entire dimension of the game. But, you know, that's your choice.
Yeah, and it kind of doesn't give you enough time to set up your expectations to then allow them to be subverted in a sort of meaningful way, I guess, but you still get the idea of what's going on.
Right, and if that's all people want is just the idea of what it was like and they're not really interested in solving 600 and something puzzles.
Right.
You know,
it's a lot.
Yeah, it's, I mean, it's a large time investment, and, you know, mm-hmm. some of the puzzles are damn hard, and but I super completed it. You know, everything,
mm-hmm.
As far as I know, anyway, or as much as he'll admit.
Sorry. That's
but he's very evasive about it.
Yeah.
So.
Yeah.
I got a quick question to ask, because this is something that's interested me for ages, and I wasn't around at the time to experience. Did you struggle to go from interactive fiction where you type into a parser to the arguably less interactive and engaging clicking on stuff form of gameplay?
Well, I mean, yeah, I had to make that transition, but
yeah.
the hard part of the transition wasn't the form of the medium. It was the logistics of creating it.
Hmm.
So as when I was working in Infocom, you know, they called the game designers in Infocom were called implementers
yes.
for some reason. I
That's
don't
a
know.
Little high and mighty,
and,
but it's cool.
And we were essentially the sole authors and coders and debuggers of the game, and in my case, package designer.
Wow.
That's
yeah, I mean,
cool.
Yeah, we did. I did everything in those games. Those are really authored games
mm-hmm.
in every sense of the word, right? Mm-hmm. Whereas when I went to do Loom, I suddenly had a team. It was a very small team by today's standards. You know, just two full-time artists, a couple of part-time artists, a few part-time testers. I did 99% of the code and all of the writing. But even managing that small team and having to communicate the vision and the needs was almost unbearable. And then I hit the dig.
Wow.
20 people.
Wow.
And you know, chaos ensues. But
no pun intended.
Yeah, so that right. Yeah, right. So, but you know, I mean, that to me was harder than dealing. So yeah, the interactivity in the graphic adventures, I mean, you're much more limited. There's much less expression possible, right? Mm. The variety expression is extremely limited. I mean, using the standard, say, Maniac Mansion Thimbleweed Park interface, it's basically a text adventure interface. You pick a verb, you pick a noun, occasionally you pick an indirect object. And you're forming sentences,
right?
Yeah,
right. Which the avatar then executes,
mm-hmm.
right? So I broke that. You know, I threw all that away for Loom.
Yeah,
but, which made it arguably even less interactive, right? But I was going for more of a story that you played through. More, I mean, kind of, it's almost, I guess you could call it almost a precursor to a walking sim, although it does have puzzles.
It definitely has puzzles, yeah.
Yeah, well, it has puzzles, but they're not difficult, and it's designed so you can't proceed if you've left something behind.
Right.
Right.
So you can't die, and you can't leave anything behind.
Right.
So that's very deliberate.
I would say that Loom arguably has one of the better aha moments in puzzle design, when you realize that you can play the drafts backwards.
The palindromes, right? When you encounter the tornado, that's the moment where you have this moment of insight. Oh, they work backwards! Yay! Mm. You know.
So, yeah. And then you tear at our heartstrings when the draft to unmake Hetchel is not the palindrome, and it's like, oh shucks.
So it was a great out, right? I could avoid Imperial entanglements just by picking a palindromic draft, right?
So. Exactly, yeah.
Hand of God.
Yeah. Two things. One, you sort of preemptively answered the question that I had for you that I kind of want to touch a little bit more on, which was how did you handle going from solo design to teamwork? But also I wanted to touch.
I didn't handle it.
Well, let's get into that, because I had a similar experience recently in the last game I did. I kind of went from being a one man show to working on a team, and I also,
and we weren't even a big team, really.
No, we were a team of, it was Ben and me and a musician. And an overseer.
And then a portrait artist.
and a portrait artist.
Yeah.
Right. So that's about the size of the Loom team.
Right. Yeah. Okay. So, yeah, I found it pretty challenging being the only person on the team who had come from really just working solo. And so, yeah, I'm curious kind of what your experiences were. And, you know, you can be as candid as you like or as whatever
like. I was really fortunate in that the two main people I worked with, Gary Winnick and Mark Ferrari, were very mature and very patient with me, because I was used to just like making design decisions and then changing them. I mean, in a text adventure, if you want to change, add something to a scene or remove it or add a tornado or a hurricane or an earthquake, you do it.
Right.
And in a minute, it's over, right?
Right.
And it's done. Whereas in Loom, if I want to add a feature, I have to ask an expensive artist to go spend several hours doing this thing that I might not like.
Right. Right. Right.
So you have to understand that at this point at Lucasfilm Games, the games were still being designed very much by improvisation.
Right.
Even though they had small teams, they were basically making them up as they went along.
Mm-hmm.
There was no overarching design document. There was no asset list. Nothing like that. I'd say Monkey Island 1 was probably the last game to use the improvisational model. Once they hit CD-ROM and suddenly the size and number of assets, you know, went up by orders of magnitude. Then you had to design it completely up front, or you were dead.
Right.
And this is part of what drew in the dig, is that transition happened right then.
Yeah.
Right. Yeah.
We were going from the improvisational, let's just sit around and brainstorm, and yeah, we'll throw this stuff together and get an artist and he'll add this. And everything was done by accretion, right?
Mm-hmm.
And Loom was sort of made that way, although I knew the overall arcing story, I knew which guilds would be there, but there were lots of things I kind of made up as I went along, and sometimes if I needed a piece of art and the guys weren't there, I would make it.
Mm-hmm. Okay.
Because, because it was so low res, you know, you didn't need a lot of shops.
Sure.
So, if I needed a special effect or something, for instance, the scene where Hetchel, where Chaos finally gets fed up with Hetchel and turns her into a roast duck. So I had somebody made the roast duck on the plate, but I had the idea of having the plate fall a little bit sooner than the duck and have it land on it, just for effect. Yeah. And so I separated the plate from the duck and did the special animation just because I wanted it to look that way.
Oh, nice.
That's
you know,
cool.
but it was just a little touch I thought was really important, right?
Yeah.
So I took an hour or two out of my programming time to do that piece of animation, right? So,
right.
So in Loom we were still at the scale where some improvisation was possible, but Gary Winnick, I can tell you for sure that Gary Winnick got very tired of me coming in and saying, "Can you make Bobbin do this gesture?" Could you add this gesture? Because I wanted to show him doing things, and after a while he got very weary of that, right? Because the other games just had them, basically they would walk, and they might have one or two gestures, like a point maybe.
I
wanted him to do stuff, you know, and I wanted to see it.
Yeah, I remembered Loom was probably one of the first games that I noticed that had actual body language. Because I know they kind of doubled down on that with Monkey Island 2. There was, like, Guybrush would point and do all these things. But I remember Bob and... There's this... I mean, I know we... There is a certain version of Loom which will not be named. But that was the actual version that I played first.
Not the horrible thing that's on Steam. Not that.
Yeah, the CD-ROM version that came with my external single-speed CD-ROM with version.
Voice acting.
But they actually did one thing. I mean... They did one thing that's not in the EGA version that I, at the time, thought was kind of cute, which when Bobbin's speaking to the shepherds at when he first meets them and he's telling them about the swans, he says, yeah, you know, swans, birds. And when he says that, he outstretches his arms and flaps them up and down. And I always thought that was a fun little touch, but it's in the version we don't talk about, so let's ignore it.
No, I mean, you know, if I had room to do that and could have convinced Gary Winnick with candy or liquor to do that stuff, I would have done it. But, you know, I mean, it came to a point where if I walked into his office and started talking about Bob and he would pick up a protractor or something else with sharp edges and show it to me.
At least he didn't get a needle and thread and, like, threaten to stab you with it or anything
that. So, but, yeah, I mean, I think it's great. I mean, I would have done a lot more than that if we'd had time and disk space. But, you know, I was limited to 8 floppy disks.
Of course,
And the last floppy was entirely devoted to the finale sequence. So basically 7 discs for the rest of the game. And, you know, you can only fit so much. I mean, the entire game, this is bizarre. Remember, it was, so we're talking 8 floppy disks, each of which holds 350 kilobytes. So the entire size of the game, uncompressed, is about 2.2 megabytes. That's it, the entire game.
And you guys were really, like, blazing trails with dithering and stuff like that at the time.
Oh, that was Ferrari. You know, Ferrari came up with the dithering, and at first, when he did it, they looked at it and said, "That's beautiful, but we can't compress that." And then there's the story I related to GDC where he did this beautiful Twilight scene and just left it on the monitor and went to lunch, you know, and everyone was crowded around it saying, "How can we put this in?
Yeah, we need this."
And, you know, they found a way to compress it. You know, they found a, you know, they found a pattern recognition thing, and they did it. And, I mean, look at Thimbleweed Park.
Yeah.
All the settings, all the backgrounds, they're from Loom.
Right.
It looks just like Loom.
Yeah. Right. Yep.
The whole game is set in that same twilight, right?
Yeah.
Did you feel like you were also, like, blazing trails with the dig? Because that game seems so cinematic in tone, and obviously I'm not sure what quite level Spielberg was involved, if any, in the actual game, but, like, compared to this, like, the LucasArts stuff before, which is like, I want to be a pirate, you sort of walk around, playing the dig felt like watching a film that you can play to me.
So the version as published was quite a bit less ambitious than the version as planned.
Right.
Yeah.
The ending, for example, was completely different and of quite a larger scale. But again, when I was in production on the game, we were expected to ship the game on 8 floppy disks.
Are you serious?
Because CD-ROM had not yet happened.
Wow. Oh, well, that's true.
Yeah, of course.
1991 here.
Right.
CD-ROM is just beginning to appear on the horizon, and we had not yet committed to it. You know, we were still aiming at 8 floppies. So I had an 8 floppy game, and I had 3 video effect sequences that had been produced by ILM, which, had they been shipped, would have eaten all 8 discs. Just the video, right?
Wow.
So never mind the rest of the game, right? So,
yeah.
So I'm, this is a game that was screaming for CD-ROM, but I didn't have it.
Right.
But by the time it got remade, they did have it.
Right.
So they were able to go, you know, do the full voicing thing and all that stuff I would have dreamed of having. In my iteration, they finally had, but, you know, it took 5 years to get there, right?
That's so long.
Yeah.
I don't know if you know this. It's not widely known, but The Dig is actually the best-selling of all the LucasArts adventures.
Yeah.
I did know that.
And which is amazing.
Full Throttle's up there as well. I mean, it makes sense at the point if you look at those games. They're like films. Who doesn't want to play a cool film?
Yeah.
Right. So, but, yeah, so there was a lot of yeah, it, a lot more was planned for the dig than actually ended up in the shipped version. A lot of my stuff is there, but a lot of it got removed. And, you know, kudos to the guys for finishing it. You know, I had mm-hmm. a fully, I left it in an alpha stage, but they had to rework it for CD-ROM, for one thing, and right. secondly, mm-hmm. because kind of I wasn't there to say how to finish it, so they kind of had to make it up, right? So, so they did. I mean, considering what happened with the, and its tortured history, mm. it came out okay, you know, and yeah. And it ended up making a great deal of money, and everyone was happy, and so the story has a happy ending for George, anyway. So, yeah. So that's nice. Yeah. I'm glad he wasn't disappointed. Because remember, we don't want to lose money was one of the things, right?
Of course, yes. So, that was great. That the fact that you guys had so much creative freedom and just had those like three tenets to go by. I think it was three, right?
Well, the two were two. There were two. Is like
it was two.
Like,
right.
Don't lose money and don't embarrass George.
Right. That was it. Yeah.
Did they? Did the early adventure games make a lot of money? Because I got the impression
Monkey Island sold maybe 35,000 units in the United States. That's all. That's I think crazy. It actually sold better in Germany.
Yeah.
Okay. Yeah. Wow.
Germans were always huge fans of the LucasArts games. They're always among the biggest customers. But no, those adventure games did not sell particularly well, which is why when CD-ROM happened and their production costs suddenly skyrocketed, they couldn't make them anymore.
Yeah.
Because the audience did not increase by an order of magnitude, but the production cost did.
Yeah,
that makes sense.
So that's why they died in a nutshell, because we couldn't afford to make them at the level of, say, you know, Full Throttle or Grim Fandango. We couldn't afford that. There weren't enough people buying them, right?
Yeah.
Because they were playing 3D games by then. You know, Wolfenstein 3D come out, and Doom and Quake. And everyone was into real-time 3D, and the 2D graphic adventures were beginning to look long in the tooth. Sound familiar? Yeah, same thing happened to me with text.
So. Yeah, right.
Yeah. So actually, going back a bit, from a design perspective, you were mentioning about how, we were talking a little bit about how the graphical adventures kind of limited interactivity. I mean, my experience has just always been designing point-and-click adventure games, and I've kind of dabbled, like in the early days when I was still doing it as a hobby, I sort of dabbled in trying out a text parser. And to me, it just seemed overwhelming, just having to have the foresight of all the possible things that people could be able to type without resorting to just generic responses for things, or the dreaded "I don't understand that" sort of thing. How did you sort of think about that when you were designing text adventures?
Well, I mean, we had the best technology available at the time.
Mm-hmm.
Infocom produced its games on a DEC System 20 mainframe.
Mm-hmm.
We actually had more computing power than most third world countries at the time. Literally.
Well,
literally.
Those guys no came from like those and, guys came from that and, sort of background.
And we were writing our games in a Lisp dialect. I mean, it was very powerful stuff. But the machines these games were running on were toys.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, we had to make them run on 32 kilobytes of memory. You know, it's like they were toys. The fact that they operated at such a sophisticated level is really a tribute to the really amazing engineering that went into that.
Right, the Z machine.
But nowadays, what we could do today. If the technology we have now were applied to text to prose adventures, oh my God! I mean, I can use Node to hook into the Watson AI. That thing can understand any sentence and bring me back a parse tree that I can take apart in seconds, microseconds, right? I mean, it's so little power compared to what's there now. But I feel like there's no interest in. Or at least not very much in exploring that as a medium. I mean, a lot of people are using the people who are still using text adventures are using things like Inform,
which is
very nice, except that it's based on the Infocom engine. Underneath, it is still an Infocom compliant compiler, and it's designed for those limitations. And so, by definition, it can't get much better, right? Unless you throw away the virtual machine, which Zarf did, actually. He came up with a much bigger one. But even then, you've got the problem of that tremendous versatility, you know, and flexibility of input requires a tremendous amount of effort to cover all the possible actions and all the things a person might want to try. And then, of course, you know, most of the time you're going to fall back on a default response.
Which,
you know, and people, the thing is, people quickly adapt. When they played those games, they, within a few minutes, they were not typing in English anymore. They were typing in Infocommese.
Right.
Simple imperative sentences.
Right.
You know, we recognize more synonyms than everybody else, and we recognize a few additional sentence structures. But basically, you were very limited, and you soon learned to adapt to the limitations. And, you know, when people think about, you know, I don't understand that sentence, that was Scott Adams stuff. We understood pretty well.
He had, like, a two-word parser, if I remember
correctly. Yeah, the two-word parser, I mean, that's where I cut my teeth was on those games.
Right.
You know? We could do so much more now. I mean, so much more that it's almost inconceivable. The problem is that now we would need artificial intelligence to assist the designer in fleshing out the gigantic world of possibilities. Because we literally can now understand almost anything you'd want to say to a game.
Yeah,
we can understand it pretty well, and so fleshing out a world like that requires automated assistance. It can't be done by hand.
It almost feels like playing like a tabletop D&D game where an AI would be the DM.
Exactly.
I guess. Yeah.
Exactly. That's what you would need. So I mean, my vision is to use crowdsourced testing. So now we can have you play a Parser style game and collect all of the inputs and see what people are trying to express and change the game in real time to understand that. And an AI can do that. And what's more, an AI can play the game while the other AI is learning, and they can develop the game at the speed of light.
It reminds me of that I guess the AI where you guess you have to get the guy to guess a celebrity and it crowdsources like input, and if he doesn't get he gets you to put your
I forget the name of it, but it's like that genie guy.
Yeah. That's how it learns, is by failing and then you correct it.
Right
So that's machine learning, right? And
you're
so right. Imagine machine learning applied to a text adventure parser where thousands of people are playing your game and it is learning what people want to express. It can ask the player, is this what you meant?
Right.
And you can respond to it and with the AI develop the conversational chops to cover almost anything. And then, you know, game authorship augmented by AI, right? So that you can cover, you know, a galaxy of possibilities that would be impossible to craft by hand. And we have this capability right now. It's just nobody's, as far as I know, nobody's really exploring it.
We don't have the Call of Duty budgets going into it sort of thing.
I don't think you need that kind of budget. Watson is free for students. I have projects that use Watson AI and other AI image recognition stuff. I mean, we use this stuff all the time. It's free. You just set up a node server and you're on. And you're accessing the same giant mainframes that banks and medical companies are using. I mean, you have access to that power, right? It's a strange world.
It is, yeah. I wonder, like, at what point does the author coach the AI? Like, I wonder where... It's a whole new territory. Obviously, you have to have a human coaching and say, well, we want to do a science fiction story.
So at first it's obvious that you need a human coaching it. But frankly, if you watch a lot of the superhero movies that are coming out, they already appear to have been made by computers.
Right.
The images are completely computer generated. The soundtrack could have been, and the script is as robotic as the rest of it. I mean, an AI could have made Superman versus Batman. In fact, I think an AI probably would have done it better. So we're not that far away from, you know, you just feed in your marketing parameters and it outputs the movie. So there was that film that came out last year where there were two trailers. One was a trailer made by the filmmakers and another one was made by Watson. They gave Watson the entire film.
Wow.
Really?
Gave it some emotional parameters of how to make a trailer, and it output a trailer that was not half bad. And that was just its first attempt.
Wow.
That's right? Incredible. So if you train Watson, you say, okay, this is what's good about the trail you made, and this could be improving. The next time it does it, it's going to get better and keep going.
I wonder if John Blow is actually an AI.
I mean, we're already at the point where the people who create these AIs don't actually know what's going on in them anymore.
Yeah, that's wow. That's incredible.
So the connections have become so complex that they don't. The state of the machine is not actually known. This is both wonderful and terrifying.
Yeah, we're going to have a Westworld situation.
So it's great as long as you don't give that AI hands.
Right.
Yeah. Right. As long as you don't give it any affordances in the physical world, you're probably okay. But if you put it like in control of a car,
yeah,
then I get worried. And if you put it in control of an atomic missile, then I get very concerned.
Yeah.
Right.
I'm curious.
Be very careful.
Is there any precedent of AI subverting expectations through creativity like a human could do? Like when you get surprised by a human's creativity?
Absolutely. I mean, so there are AI, there are novel writing competitions. Mm-hmm. AI researchers would create a novel writing algorithm and submit it to a traditional, you know, writing competition, and they have won prizes. And then
wow.
they reveal it was written by an AI.
That's incredible.
Okay?
Wow.
So if you want to get novelty out of an AI, just give it a random number generator.
Okay, that
right?
makes sense.
And it'll start coming up with stuff. And some of it, most of it will be crap, but some of it will be genius.
Right.
Or at least really interesting. Right? Mm. And it can do that so quickly. And iterate so rapidly. So imagine you're working on a game, and you tell the AI, I'm not quite sure what should happen here. And the AI knows the plot of every Disney movie and every Hans Christian Andersen fable and every fantasy film ever made and all the works of Ray Bradbury, and it can draw from all that and suggest things,
mm-hmm.
right? And
that makes sense.
New possibilities and show you them, and you could say, yes, we'll do that, but with a little more orange. And you know, this computer-assisted authorship is very interesting.
I guess it's like the 99 monkeys in Shakespeare thing, except it's 9 billion monkeys per second.
Yeah, but yes, except that there can still be an author there. You don't have to give it total control. You
right.
give as much control as you want, and you use its vast resources as to augment your own creativity, right? I think there's a lot of promise in that, and I would love to explore that. There have been some tremendous breakthroughs in voice recognition thanks to Alexa. With its microphone array, which is able to, you know, use wave guiding to pinpoint voice.
Mm-hmm.
Alexa is really, really good at voice recognition. Maybe a little too good because it's always listening.
Right.
So, for instance, I have some students who live in a dormitory room in their suite. They have an Alexa in their common living space, which they use to, you know, for music and stuff. And one evening, they weren't using it, but it was turned on. They were talking about magic. Magicians, and they were talking about the classic linking rings effect, you know, where the magician appears to take solid rings and link them together and pull them apart.
Right, right.
They were just discussing this, right? So one of the persons in the room is one of my students who does not have an Alexa account, suddenly began to see ads for linking rings on his Amazon.
Oh, wow.
So A, it was listening and knew what they were talking about, and B, somehow it deduced that he was in the room.
Wow. That's crazy.
Just think about that. So a couple
That's
of last
terrifying.
Week, I booked reservations in Omaha, Nebraska.
Uh-huh.
A few minutes later, I went on Facebook, and it started showing me friend recommendations for people I did not know in Omaha.
Wow. Yeah, that's worrying.
Yeah. So what's going on under there? Who... Does the Red Roof Inn have a deal with Facebook?
Maybe. Who knows?
Right?
We're laughing, but we're laughing
right?
terrified.
I mean,
yeah, we are.
Literally minutes later, it was recommending people I had never heard of who were in Omaha.
Wow.
Like, okay, that's...
Yeah.
Pretty, so, they say, yeah, we got to watch out. But I see a lot of potential for augmented creativity. In all fields, in novel writing, filmmaking, everything. I mean, eventually, you know, programming skills won't be needed. And
right.
hooray for that, because then the best designers won't be the best coders, the best engineers, they'll be the best dreamers.
Cool, because...
And that's where we want to be.
You don't need an
that's
author
we want
to set yeah. print or, you know, create paper. An author should just be able to touch the key.
Hmm.
Why touch the key? Why not just speak?
Right.
That's
how I use my GPS.
Just daydream out loud.
Yeah.
Just daydream out loud, or eventually you won't even have to speak it. It'll hear your thoughts.
Mm-hmm.
We'll be there.
Yeah. All right. Well, I think this is probably a good place to wrap up. I know you got to run, so we thank you very much.
One more time.
Yeah, well, no, it's fine. But thanks for coming on, and this is usually the part at the end where we self-promote, so we'll let you go first. If anybody has been living under a rock and has no idea who we've been talking to for the past 45 minutes, tell us where we can find you online or anything we can look into to see your presence online.
Oh, well, if you just Google my name, I'm on Wikipedia. There are errors there, though. That's not reliable. I actually use that as an example to my students why they should not use Wikipedia. I bring them to my Wikipedia page and I point out all the errors. And then I tell them how I have tried to correct those errors and I've been superseded by other people who think they know my life better than I do.
That's also worrying.
Right. So, but I'm just Google me.
All right. Well, good. Well, I'm at Grunislav Games on Twitter.
And I'm at Ben_304.
And together we are at BCT_podcast. That's our little gimmick. Anyway, thank you again, Professor.
You guys have to rehearse that to get it right.
Well, it helps that we're in the same room. Usually, Ben's in Australia and I'm here, and the lag doesn't help it. It's actually a bonus. It's all right. Anyway, thank you again so much for joining us. And thanks everybody for listening. Bye.
Okay. Thanks, Brian. Bye.
Yep.